Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, November the 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the presidential election just 6 days away, and the polls are tightening. But could the state of Florida be the ultimate decider?
That's going to be the real key for who's going to win the presidency in terms of Florida.
Iraqi forces have entered the IS stronghold of Mosul. And also ahead, Americans are sick of the political campaign, but they are buying souvenirs. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, with less than a week until Election Day and opinion polls showing a tight race, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are shifting their campaigns into high gear, visiting states crucial for winning the White House. Trump was in Eau Claire, Wisconsin Tuesday night, urging Democratic voters who've already cast early voting ballots for Clinton to change their decision. And during a stop in Pennsylvania, another important battleground state, Trump told supporters that if he's elected, he'll call a special session to Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare.
When we win on November 8th, and elect a Republican Congress, we will be able to immediately repeal and replace Obamacare. Have to do it.
Well, the decision by the director of the Federal Bureau investigation, James Comey, last week to have his agents review newly discovered emails has given Trump some new fodder to suggest his opponent is lacking in honesty. Clinton, who has said Comey's announcement so close to the election was outrageous, was campaigning Tuesday in Florida, where she questioned Trump's alleged failure to pay taxes.
Now we know that Donald Trump meant, when he says he was smart for not paying his fair share, he meant that he used what the New York Times called, and I quote, a legally dubious scheme to avoid paying taxes. Even his own high-priced lawyers warned him it likely wouldn't fly with the IRS, and he took everything. He took everything our great country has to offer. He scooped it up with both hands and then paid nothing to support us.
Well, a key state in winning the election is Florida, which is why both candidates have been spending so much time there. Daniel Smith is a professor of political science at the University of Florida. He tells us about the state's impact.
When you take a look at Florida's demographics, we do skew older, but what is really the hallmark of Florida voting is that older voters tend to turn out disproportionately more than their younger compatriots who are registered to vote. So it's not only that we're an old state, it's that older voters vote at a much higher rate than younger voters. And so it disproportionately skews the electorate to an older and as well as a whiter electorate. That said, we now have about 17% of our registered voters are Hispanic, about 13.5% are African American. And what we're seeing so far is that Hispanic voters are turning out to vote at a rate that is much higher than they did in 2012. African Americans, not so much. And that's going to be the real key for who's going to win the presidency in terms of Florida, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, in terms of the next week of early voting, absentee ballots coming in, as well as, of course, on Election Day on November 8th. Hillary Clinton has had a very strong presence on the ground in terms of not only volunteers but paid staffers. They are going to be crucial in terms of getting people to turn out to vote who haven't already voted early or by mail.
Well, meanwhile, money does play a major role in U.S. politics, and this election has involved a lot of it. Joining me now on this is Robert Boatwright, professor of political science at Clark University. Now, the Clinton campaign has had a major advantage over Trump when it comes to campaign money. Has this helped her take the lead?
She was able to use money early on, I think, to create a presence in all of the battleground states. So it's not really showing up in the poll results, but I think what is likely to happen over the upcoming week is that the Clinton campaign ought to be able to use the apparatus they've constructed to contact voters in all of the swing states. So my guess, and I could be totally wrong about this, but my guess is that most of the closed states are going to break in her direction because of the amount of money she was able to spend there months ago.
Does the fact that it has been so close, given the money disparity between the two. What does that tell you?
It suggests, first of all, that both candidates kind of have a ceiling and a floor as far as how much support they're likely to get. It's quite possible that a more typical kind of Republican would have been running even with Clinton or better. It's not really clear that Trump's lack of money has hurt him a tremendous amount, but it does, I think, indicate that he doesn't really have much of a campaign organization. So if you read things coming from the people in his campaign, who are doing the analytics, who are doing the efforts to project what voters are going to do, I wouldn't say they're making things up, but they are trying to do things that nobody's done before, and we don't really have any idea whether it's all going to work. Whereas for the Clinton campaign, they essentially have a model for what you do with a few hundred million dollars, which is to do basically the same thing that the Obama campaign did back in 2012. They have a strategy that has been proven to work.
Would you say that the money disparity in the primaries is what got Hillary Clinton to beat Bernie Sanders?
I wouldn't say that. They had different kinds of money. Sanders was able to very effectively raise small-dollar contributions, and he did have quite a bit of money in the primary. So I don't know that by itself that was different. I think that Hillary followed pretty much the same strategy that she followed in 2008 in regards to how she raised money and how she spent money. And the dynamics of this year were not what they were in 2008. It was really a two-person race from the beginning. So no, I wouldn't say she beat Sanders because of the money, but I would say that she was able to do very different kinds of things with her money than Sanders did.
Would you say that money in general and the amount of money that goes into our political campaigns has really altered the democracy of the whole process?
It's kind of taken things out of the hands of candidates. I think the Democratic Party hasn't really, first of all, they haven't suffered the way people thought that they would. The predictions back in 2010 were that corporate money was going to favor Republicans and the Democrats were going to have an awful lot of difficulty. But Democrats have figured out how to raise money fairly effectively and to sort of centralize the super PAC money that they raise. So I don't think that that has come true. I don't think that yet the Democratic Party has really been affected that much by the decision. I think what it's done is, it was evident in the Republican primary, more so than the Democratic primary, that the whims of a handful of relatively wealthy people can basically prolong the process, right? What we saw in the primaries was that there were a lot of big donors who put money behind rather idiosyncratic causes, who wanted to spend money the way they wanted to spend it. And so the Republican Party, I think, has been harmed because there have been a lot of individuals who've put a lot of money into the process, and they haven't all been working on the same team, so to say. They've been battling against each other, and in many cases they've put money behind candidates who couldn't win but who could prolong the process and make things very difficult for the kind of establishment candidates.
All right, Robert Boatwright, professor of political science at Clark University. We appreciate your perspective. Turning now to what's been trending on social media, Michael Lippin is here with us. Michael, with just a week to go for the U.S. presidential election, what is the chatter on Twitter?
Hi, Lori. Well, today it's the turn of a former Miss Universe, a 39-year-old Venezuelan-born American actress, Alicia Machado. She became a center of attention in September when her name came up in the first U.S. presidential debate. It was Democrat nominee Hillary Clinton who cited Machado as a victim of misogyny from Republican nominee Donald Trump, who owned the Miss Universe pageant at the time that Machado won it. Now, today Machado campaigned with Hillary in Dade City, Florida, and as the former Miss Universe spoke to the crowd, she repeated the insults that she says Trump directed at her, and Machado says Trump called her Miss Piggy and Miss Housekeeping, mocking her weight and her Latin background. Now, in the presidential debate, Trump expressed surprise about those insults, although he hasn't explicitly denied saying them. Now, Alicia Machado is on Twitter, at Machado Oficial, and a short time ago, she tweeted an Instagram picture of her and Hillary Clinton raising their joined hands at the Florida rally.
Wow, so what are Twitter users saying about that campaign appearance?
Hillary supporters are obviously happy that Machado was bringing up an issue that has hurt Trump with female voters, his history of insulting remarks about women. But Hillary critics were also quite vocal, arguing that Machado is hardly a good role model or campaign surrogate for Hillary. Now, in late September, U.S. media reported that in the late 1990s, a judge in Venezuela accused Machado of threatening to kill him for indicting her then-boyfriend for attempted murder. One Trump supporter on Twitter wrote that if the Hillary Clinton campaign is recycling Alicia Machado, they're in full-blown panic mode and straight out of options.
Okay, well, I also hear the iPhone is trending. What's going on there?
The yet-to-be-released iPhone 8 that's trending on Facebook with more than 1 million people talking about it. Now, it's just been over a month since Apple released the iPhone 7 here in the U.S., and already attention is turning to what will be next year's expected iPhone 8. The tech news site Mashable says that iPhone 8 could include wireless charging for the first time. Now, that prospect has lots of people commenting on Mashable's Facebook post of the story. User Jeremy Jones is cynical, saying, "Wireless charging has been out for a while now, but if Apple does it 3 years after the fact, then they are tech innovators." Now, someone who's more optimistic on Facebook, Ram Kanda, he says, "If Apple have indeed figured out how to charge things like the iPhone over some distance, that's a huge and welcome improvement." Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. You can follow him at Michael Lippin. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. warns of a possible IS attack in India. Opioid epidemic in the U.S. also hitting children and teens. Syrian government rebels could face Aleppo war crimes accusations. And Glamour magazine selects Bono as its first Man of the Year. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now. There are disturbing reports coming from Iraq of mass killings by Islamic State and IS militants using civilians as human shields. United Nations spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani.
"What we have observed is a pattern that ISIL is taking people closer and closer to Mosul City. Initially, they had moved a lot of people into Hammam al-Alil, and then they started moving people from Hammam al-Alil closer to Mosul City. We also have reports that they are putting people very close to their offices and to military installations, to what would be military targets. Now, that seems to support the assertion that they are planning to use these people as human shields, as well as to make sure that the area is heavily populated with civilians to frustrate a military operation against them. They are also killing some people that they are abducting, especially people who formerly belonged to the Iraqi security forces."
Well, meanwhile, Iraqi forces have entered the IS-held city of Mosul, but continue to face stiff resistance. VOA's Victor Beatty talks about the operation with Abdul Qadir Sino, Associate Professor of Political Science and Middle Eastern Studies at Indiana University.
"The progress is accelerating, and that's because, of course, the damage that ISIS has been sustaining is cumulative. And they're having a hard time replenishing their forces. And so there have been steady acceleration of the gains and for the Iraqis, or this is factions fighting ISIS, and the gains that they have been able to accomplish. Now it's estimated that ISIS has just a couple of thousand fighters at most in Mosul, which is much less than the number of fighters it could muster in its heyday in Iraq."
Of course, the Iraqi forces are made up of Iraqi police and soldiers, elite troops. They're also Kurdish Peshmerga, but Shia militia, who are approaching from a different side in this Sunni-dominated conflict. Are they going to pose a problem?
"Yes, they will pose a problem, because there is no political solution to what's happening in northern Iraq yet. We already have a humanitarian disaster take place right now in Mosul and other areas, caused in part by ISIS itself and in part by its opponents. And there's no political solution to address that humanitarian disaster and what will happen later in this region. The grievances that led to the creation of ISIS still exist. And if ISIS is destroyed now, but there is no solution, another alternative to ISIS will emerge in the future. And those Shiite militias play a role in aggravating those grievances.
This shows a close tie between Iraq and Iran.
Yes, absolutely. The Iraqi government is closely backed by Iran to start with, and the Shiite militias are also closely linked to Iran. I mean, those are the descendants of organizations that took shelter in Iran during the Saddam Hussein era and re-entered Iraq after that regime was destroyed.
Is this showing a growing influence that Iran has over its neighbor?
Yes. Iran is incredibly influential in Iraq, and the aid it provides to the Iraqi government dwarfs, to some degree, American aid, not in terms of money, but in terms of support in other ways.
Does that pose a problem for U.S. policy?
Absolutely. In fact, since the United States invaded Iraq, what it succeeded in doing is establishing a regime that's closer to Iran than it will ever be to the United States.
How long do you think it will take for this operation to complete? A U.S. coalition spokesman said on Tuesday that this conflict to free Mosul could take months.
It may be shorter than that, but it will not be easy. The number of fighters ISIS has in Mosul is limited. On the other hand, they have just been cut off from Syria, and they are isolated, and so it is a fight to the death. And those are dedicated people, and they will fight to the death.
All right, that's Abdelkader Sino, Associate Professor of Political Science and Middle Eastern Studies at Indiana University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people will choose their new president. This historic campaign comes to an end, and a new president is chosen. Our coverage will feature all of VOA's correspondents across the U.S. and around the world. Tune into our live comprehensive coverage between 00 and 0300 UTC GMT Wednesday morning, November 9th, right here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Americans may be suffering from election overload, but it's been a good year for stores selling campaign souvenirs. A store owner in Washington, D.C. says sales of campaign buttons and T-shirts are a pretty accurate indicator of who will be the next president. Mil Arcega reports.
Just a few blocks away from the real White House, this souvenir store in Washington is teeming with customers. Most eager to see the end of this election season.
Just going on and on and on and on, all the name calling.
And yet, here they are, buying T-shirts, bobbleheads, and fridge magnets to remember what this woman says will be a historic election.
Well, I'm getting things that are not going to be here after the election.
It's been a profitable election season for store owner Jim Warlick, who's been tracking percentage sales of presidential campaign buttons for 35 years. For example, after the Republican and Democratic conventions in August,
it was 62 Hillary, 38 Trump.
And then, after the debates,
it was 57 Hillary and 43 Trump. So it had that
so
narrowed.
So it's narrowed.
It has.
But interestingly enough, the hottest seller this 2016 election season isn't even on the ballot box.
Actually, Michelle is more popular than the president, so we're sort of doing a Michelle line. And so the two legacies of the president and the first lady are selling more than both Clinton and Trump.
Warlick has correctly predicted the outcome of every presidential race since 1980, except in 2000 when Al Gore lost to George W. Bush. Based on sales, he's already placed his order for 2017 inaugural souvenirs, and he broke with protocol to share his prediction with Voice of America.
I watch the polls quite a bit daily and my merchandise daily, so I would say it's going to be Clinton.
It's going to be Clinton.
It's going to
okay,
be Clinton.
And we heard it here first from Jim Warlick.
The lesson here, says Warlick, is that people do vote with their pocketbooks. Mil Arcega, VOA News, Washington.
Well, it has been nearly 4 years since 20 children and 6 educators were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Newtown, a new documentary that looks at the effect the massacre had on the small town and the country.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, what's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's going on.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get everybody you can going down there.
It's still happening.
The film opens with the horrified voices of people calling 911 to report the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The new documentary, Newtown, uses first-person interviews with some of the victims' families, neighbors, and co-workers to tell the story. Mark Barden's son, Daniel, was one of those killed.
I still have a little secrets stashed around. He used to wear this old yellow football helmet when he'd ride in the little seat in the back of my bicycle. And I have that in the garage, and it still has some beautiful little long blonde hairs of his in it.
In one scene, Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was also shot, shows a room stacked with boxes of condolence cards, gifts, and other items from well-wishers.
This is most of the stuff that's been, I don't even know how many thousands of letters and gifts and portraits. So many of them have never been opened because I just can't do that yet.
Kim Snyder, who also directed Welcome to Shelbyville about Somali refugee immigrants in small-town America, is Newtown's director.
And we felt we had not seen a film like this that had really looked at the trajectory of up to 3 years. We filmed over the course of 3 years. Sadly, there's been so many since, but I think Newtown, for so many people, was a watershed moment and really needed to be, you know, we needed to bear witness to that so that with the hope that that something could change.
Maria Cuomo-Cole is the film's producer. She says that the filmmakers wanted to remain sensitive to the pain community members were in, but also wanted to highlight the bravery and endurance shown by Newtown.
Kim and I felt it was extremely important to be as sensitive as possible, of course, in telling this important story, a story that, you know, we don't have the luxury to forget in America. It's hard stuff, but it's part of who we are. And hopefully, you know, we can learn from it and create change to keep communities safe.
Do you promise to live life to its fullest?
I do!
Do you promise to cherish family and friends?
I do!
The film takes a hopeful turn when it shows community members taking part in the Daniel Barden Mudfest, an endurance race that benefits several charities. Nicole Hockley has also been able to go into the room of condolence gifts and to start opening some of them. The issue of gun control has been hotly debated in this year's presidential campaign. Maria Cuomo said her hope is that Newtown will touch people's hearts on both sides of the issue and will result in change. That change has still not arrived. Earlier this year, the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history took place in Orlando, with 49 people gunned down at a nightclub. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, another DJ has found success through electronic dance music. International Edition's Sarah Williams talks about it with VOA's Border Crossings host, Larry London.
Today we're going to look at a guy who at 20 was the youngest ever to be named the world's number one DJ. And that's according to DJ Magazine. His name is Martin Garrix, and he is from the Netherlands. And right now he is doing very, very well with his project that's out these days and a new song that he's got recorded on the charts with Bibi Rexha. She's an Albanian singer who is just tearing things up. She's just hot. Now, Martin Garrix got his start when he was a teenager. In 2004, he kind of fell in love with the whole phenomenon of creating and mixing music in his own home, which he did on his laptop in his bedroom. And then about 10 years later, he released his very first song, which became a hit. And so here we are now with the new single from Martin Garrix called In the Name of Love.
If I told you this was only gonna hurt, if I warned you that the fire's gonna burn, would you walk in? Would you let me do it first? do it all in the name of love.
He had his first hit in about 2014. That was about 6 years ago, which would make him 14 at the time, because now he's 20. And now he's on the charts with In the Name of Love, which we just heard with Bebe Rexha. And that is already one of Spotify's top downloaded songs in the UK and here in the United States. And it's climbing up the charts very quickly, already a top 20 hit. He's on tour. He's performing at all the big music festivals. And he was just included in a new EDM-themed documentary, which is called What We Started, which will show the history of EDM and the recent surgence of the style of music called electronic dance music.
So EDM is going really strong.
It's an amazing phenomenon that has not been new to Europe. In Europe, they've had many, many people doing the DJ stuff for years. But here in the United States, Afrojack, Tiesto, all of these people have just come along and remixed music and also created some new music and taken the world by storm. And Martin Garrix is nominated for many, many music awards at the Teen Choice Awards and the MTV Europe Music Awards. He's nominated in just all the categories for EDM.
Very impressive. Thanks so much, Larry. That's VOA's Larry London, the host of Border Crossings.
That is going to do it for today's show, but you can always find us online anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Susan Markham, Senior Coordinator for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment for the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, wrapped up a five-day visit to Lao PDR in October, during which she met Lao education officials and visited schools to pave the way for the expansion of the U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative to Laos, which President Barack Obama announced during his visit to the country in September. Following a meeting with the Minister of Education and Sports, Senjuan Lachantabun, and senior education officials in Vientiane on October 4th, Ms. Markham and her delegation traveled to Luang Prabang and Udomche provinces, where she discussed education and learning needs with teachers, administrators, students, and parents. "We are thrilled to have this opportunity to engage with Lao officials, teachers, parents, and students to learn more about education in this beautiful country," Ms. Markham said. "Through the Let Girls Learn initiative, we can find new ways to collaborate and help ensure that adolescent girls and boys get the education they need to be successful." On October 7th, Ms. Markham met representatives of the Lao Women's Union, Lao National Commission for Mothers and Children, the Lao National Commission for the Advancement of Women's Secretariat, and other donors and civil society groups focused on women and development to further understand the needs of girls and women across Laos. The U.S. government's Let Girls Learn initiative, championed by First Lady Michelle Obama, works to address the range of challenges preventing adolescent girls from attaining a quality education. Let Girls Learn harnesses existing programs and invests in new efforts to improve educational opportunities for girls worldwide. The United States is proud to work with Laos to help Lao girls develop their full potential for their benefit and for the benefit of their communities and the people of Laos.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage. at www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's for, what's your